then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's December the 4th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, I'm speaking now on Tuesday morning, and I see on the news that Detroit has just gone completely dark. No pun intended. The entire city just lost power, apparently not because of any big storm or anything, but due to simple nigger incompetence and inability to maintain a technological society and pay the bills. Now, we'll see how that plays out over the coming weeks, but for now, it's high time we did another Edgar Steele reminder. I've let those slide recently. And I shouldn't have. In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. Now, I might point out here that neither of the women who were Steele's purported victims ever believed him to be guilty of this charge, and both supported him publicly, Cindy's mother until the day she died of natural causes, and Cindy herself to this day. The alleged would-be assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer, who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family, until, for reasons as yet unclear, Fairfax's mission ceased to become one of mere intelligence gathering and became one of perjury and personal destruction. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend a few months in county jail and then under house arrest with an ankle bracelet in the service of the Bureau. A short time after her husband was arrested, Edgar's wife Cindy pulled into a local service station for an oil change, and the mechanic found a bomb wired to the underside of her car. Not knowing that the bomb was part of an FBI fabrication against her husband, the local police called a rival federal agency, the BATFE, who refused to honor the FBI's assurance that Larry Fairfax was one of their CIs, and proceeded to arrest and charge Fairfax publicly for manufacturing and transporting the explosive device, much to the Bureau's extreme embarrassment. Now, the bomb was clearly intended to go off and kill Cindy in order to bolster the Bureau's case against Edgar and also remove a potential fly in the ointment, since Cindy was already balking at the official version of events and refusing to go along and play the victim. Now the dictatorship faced the additional complication and embarrassment of having their informer publicly exposed by the ATF, who refused to carry the FBI's water on this one. Fairfax's role in the case was eventually laughed off by the courts with a 27-month sentence. None of it in actual prison. Fairfax was removed from county jail to house arrest 5 months after Edgar Steele was sentenced to 50 years. Today, he's a free man with a nice chunk of change in his pocket, some of it from the silver he stole from Edgar Steele. Now, the trial of Edgar Steele in 2011 was an unmitigated horror show. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear, even to a layman who first hears them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically for the record that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Now, many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the dictatorship to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. The dictator's servants broke their word. Surprise, surprise. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud. I suppose there is some comfort in hoping that the bent brief will possibly die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. Now, for whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. Apparently, something even worse was happening. Now, I wasn't able to attend the trial myself, but I have spoken to persons who were present in the courtroom who told me that Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion among those who actually saw him on those days was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. On May the 5th, 2011, absent the expert testimony that could have proven his innocence, Edgar Steele was found guilty of 4 criminal charges against him. He was eventually sentenced to 50 years. Being 66 years old at the time, it was understood by all that this was a death sentence. The United States penal system maintains several special medical and geriatric units at places like Springfield, Missouri, and Fort Devens, Massachusetts, to care for federal prisoners who are extremely sick or elderly, but who caught one of these absurd 990-year sentences and who will never be released. In view of his age and the perilous state of his health, Edgar Steele should have been sent to one of these. Instead, he was sent to the heavily fortified Maximum Security Victorville facility in California, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele was sent there to die, and on September the 4th, 2014, he did. On or about that day, Edgar J. Steele was murdered in horrific circumstances which I described in a podcast at the time, and which I do not intend to go over again here. I said pretty much all that I had to say at that time, but I do not intend to let the dictatorship bury Edgar's memory. And so from now on, there's going to be periodic reminders that once there was a man who stood up for his people and his country and paid the ultimate price for it.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's June 24, 2009, and this is a nickel rant entitled Anarchy with Honor. The ongoing tension between tyranny and freedom is a recurring theme in my writing, more perhaps than any other. The circle of strife is what I have dubbed the never-ending stampeding of a populace from freedom to tyranny and back again in all nations down through history. Today, we see America sliding ever more deeply into a morass of excessive institutional control of its citizens, as clear a case of mounting tyranny as ever has been seen. To argue about differing economic models or alternate political systems is to engage in the wrong argument altogether. What I have noticed that really counts, regardless of the form of societal organization under discussion, is the degree of individualism versus collectivism. Individualism is freedom, pure and simple, anarchy, if you will. Collectivism is lack of freedom, the control of individuals by groups, whether voluntary or involuntary, as exemplified by communism, Even so, voluntary control of the individual inevitably becomes involuntarily, I've noticed, the greater it expands. Many in America today view our subjugation to the greater good of society to be a voluntary yielding up of individual liberty. A growing segment of the population, however, views the galloping expansion of institutional control with alarm. I'm among that number. Think you own your own house? Try not paying your property taxes and just see what happens. I view political philosophies as lying on a circle. To the right are conservatives, and to the left are liberals. Follow the conservatives far enough, and you encounter fascism. Follow the liberals far enough, and you encounter communism. You begin with individualism and personal freedom, and end up with total collectivist lockdown, regardless of whether you follow the liberal or conservative path. Collectivism of every stripe has as its gravamen the control of a nation's citizenry. Increased organization leads to greater control. Organization is necessary for control. From control springs the personal benefit to a nation's rulers, of course. Benevolent dictators are well and good, but always there comes the day when such leaders die, only to be replaced by not-so-benevolent dictators. Both types tend to line their pockets as their ultimate power leads to their own ultimate corruption. It does not take one long in a privileged position before one begins to perceive him or herself as different somehow, as deserving that position and its perquisites more than others. That is the path to despotism and, ultimately, personal destruction for the self-deluded and privileged few. Hundreds of years ago, the Rothschild family set itself up in banking, and from that decision sprang an empire, nay, empires aplenty, with the same people running things at every turn. The Federal Reserve System merely is today's manifestation of that control in America. It is called something different in other countries. Now here's how these people work their scheme. Cash gets siphoned continually as it works its way through any economic system, from consumer to producer and back down again. The siphoning is done by overcharging, fraud, profits, employee stock options, bonuses, taxes, and theft. The fraud, overcharging, and theft occur at all points in the system. Call it what you like, graft, juice, grease, and so on. Taxes are a peculiar form of theft, thus deserving of their own classification, since some of those taxes actually end up as benefits to the consumer, unlike the outright theft that occurs at all other places, including profits, which go into the pockets of a select few. That is why corporate taxes can be beneficial to society. They prevent the downstream theft that otherwise would occur and inure only to the benefit of a few. Now, don't blame me. That's just how the world works. As the corruption becomes more apparent to the population being fleeced, calls for greater control ring out, as in America today. That's music to the ears of the collectivists in charge, because such calls present the opportunity for even more control, and thus, even more profits. Oddly enough, there comes a point in national corruption when a little more control actually results in a fairer distribution of the bounty of that nation's economic system, as in America's health system today, which is grossly unfair to the multitudes of uninsured and underinsured middle-class Americans. As things now stand, medicine in America should be completely socialized if we are not going to throw out the entire system and replace it with something just slightly this side of anarchy. Call it real-world economics, if you like, as I do not believe that this recognition of reality that goes well beyond the hard-knock school of Austrian economics actually has a name. Edgernomics, if you will. Yes, you just heard me construct an argument for Obama's health care plan, believe it or not. Very few of us end up among the insiders who ultimately benefit from the corruption endemic to any economic or political system. We are on the outside, looking in, and only occasionally scrabbling for crumbs that fall from the table. Everything goes to one of those thieves. Everything. There is no marketplace, as argued by libertarians, because none of us truly are equals. Now and again, some of us stumble upon a rich vein of plunder, for example, a government contract, a Yale law degree, a Ponzi scheme, a corporate officership, political office, etc., thus becoming one of the insiders for a time. Normally, though, what we subsist upon are mere crumbs, plus whatever portion of the loot to which we can lay claim in the form of wages, commissions, Social Security, highway usage, or whatever. Capitalism as an economic system is a myth. Communism as an economic system is a myth. There are no different economic systems. There is only one system, and it works as I have described, regardless of the political clothing in which one dresses it. Anarchy, too, merely is a political set of clothing for this system. This is why Zionists, such as the Rothschilds, so effortlessly seem to switch from one political or economic philosophy to another and still prosper. They epitomize the ultimate game players and are genetically equipped to come out on top time and again because they ruthlessly and continually operate for their own self-interest. Idealists, like us, are mere cattle to be farmed by them. Only ruthless self-dealing can neutralize ruthless self-dealing, else one resembles the fool who brings a knife to a gunfight. Austrian economics merely comes closer than Keynesianism to describing reality. Even so, it is woefully short of the mark. Call it greed and self-interest, perhaps. That is the only enduring reality. Edgernomics. You heard it here first. Graft and corruption trump all economic and social models, always have and almost always will, simply because they are the natural byproduct of civilization and organization. A bright and shiny line can be drawn between the majority, that's us, and the corrupt in-crowd, them, the collectivists. Not a perfect overlay, but close enough to my perception of the two sides in all societies. The haves and the have-nots. The haves have because they take from the have-nots in unfair measure. Always, the haves must be in the minority for this to provide for them in the manner they demand. Haves require organization in order to cut a slice from every transaction. The slice-taking in unfair measure represents the graft, corruption, and untoward profit-taking to which I previously referred. Disorder, or anarchy, is anathema to the haves and to collectivism of every stripe. As I said, to argue about differing economic models or alternate political systems is to engage in the wrong argument altogether. The real nub, individualism versus collectivism. Without collectivism, one cannot have true order and organization, from which one exacts an unfair and often unseen advantage over others. Anarchy is a vacuum, a lack of order, and collectivism is the pressure that relentlessly fills the vacuum. Humans yearn for order and organization and belonging and being told what to do and being free from having to make decisions. Humans yearn for the yoke, not individual freedom. This is like leaving the keys in the ignition and your car door unlocked in South Central LA, because the collectivists are only too happy to oblige us by breaking the law, taking advantage of our naivete, and stealing the car. Some argue for anarchy. They think they are true anarchists, but they are not. In reality, they argue for what I have dubbed anarchy with honor. That honor is a set of rules that organizes anarchy, albeit in a minimal fashion. That minimal organization is the very minimum societal organization that I argue must be in place to hold the collectivists at bay. The American Constitution of 225 years ago accomplished that in grand fashion, but now has been displaced completely. There comes a point in over-organizing that the only way to decrease the massive corruption is to organize even further, tightening down the screws, thus My argument above for socialized medicine being more fair than what we have in America today. Yet the real solution is found in scrapping everything and starting over, pressing the national or global reset button. Corruption traverses something of a bell-shaped curve versus societal freedom, which decreases linearly through time in all society forms. Theoretically, total lockdown squeezes out corruption. That is the misguided notion that Castro employed in implementing communism in Cuba. That was Orwell's vision, told in 1984. Ultimately, however, total lockdown leads to total corruption and total slavery of the masses. The real solution, of course, is to throw out the baby with the bathwater and reset the system to the start of that bell-shaped curve. That is why Jefferson proposed revolution on a regular basis. Collectivists will not go without a fight. Yes, a civil war. Dead babies in ditches and all is inevitable, I believe. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name's Edgar J. Steele, and thanks for listening.
This is, I think, an appropriate musical number from David Bowie.
I'm you. Well, I certainly believe that. Look at the changes that have happened in the last 100 years. I can't imagine what lies ahead of us if we continue with this pace. I do have a question from one of the listeners who wanted me to ask you, who is behind the push for amnesty for the illegal immigrants, and what is their objective?
Well, the objective has been, I think, for a number of years. You might say there's two sets of objectives. One is the Republican set of objectives, which was to serve their corporate buddies by bringing the supply of cheap labor directly into the United States instead of putting everybody bother of outsourcing the jobs to Mexico, Guatemala, or Indonesia, or wherever. Like I say, Republicans are certainly no improvement over Democrats. They are servants of the great corporations, and their whole interest in bringing in all these people was to ensure a permanent supply of cheap labor, not only for the cheap labor itself, but to keep wages down and to provide a viable source of competition for expensive white labor, unionized labor. They are completely all right with there being 50 million or 34 million, however many Mexicans in this country, so long as they don't get to vote, because I think they finally figured out that the Democrats had a different objective. The Democrats want them here in order to get them amnesty, make them citizens, and get them to voting Democrat, so that this so-called democracy we have will become a permanent one-party state ruled by the Democrat Party. We are very, very close to that now. If Obama legalizes these, okay, we'll just say 34 million, for now, because that's how many green cards apparently they're going to print. But those 34 million illegals who are legalized and get their green cards will then become so many anchor babies or anchor Jose's or whatever. They will in turn bring in their uncles and cousins and mamacitas and bambinos and blah, blah. And very quickly, we will in essence be part of Latin America. What the Democrats want to create here is a long-term one-party state with a facade of democracy similar to the rule in Mexico for almost 70 years of what's called the PRI, the Party of the Institutionalized Revolution. It came out of their civil wars in the 19-teens, Pancho Villa and all that sort of stuff. Mexico for generations was ruled in essence by one party, but they still went through the motions of having a minor opposition party. And I suppose in a sense it's a good system because it does tend to last so long as you can keep the money flowing, but that's the goal of the Democrats in bringing the illegals here and amnestying them. And Obama is going to amnesty them because he's figured out that he can do whatever he wants and nobody's going to do anything. He's the first black president. I don't think he's worried about being impeached, even if the Congress does go Republican the midterm elections. And he's probably right not to do so. Like I said, the Republicans, I think, could sweep the House and sweep the Senate, get total control. And on December the 1st, he could, with a stroke of his pen, legalize 34 million illegal aliens in this country and get them all registered to vote Democrat. And I still don't think the Republicans would have the stuff to impeach him. They don't have that kind of moral courage. It'd be interesting if they did, but anyway, and of course there is a larger agenda of simply changing the racial and ethnic and demographic makeup of this country in order to exterminate the hated white men who made it and who created Western civilization. You have to understand that behind this whole thing is a very deep-seated hatred of Christianity, of the Western civilization, and basically at the bottom of it all, it's the Jews.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we get back right after this short break. Folks, stick with us. Be right back with Harold Covington. Don't go away. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, October 23rd, 2014, and my guest today is author Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back, sir.
Okay.
I talk all the time about how people need to prepare for events that we don't know are going to happen. You know, we anticipate disasters. Everybody I know, not everybody, many people I know have bug out bags and this type of thing. And, you know, folks, I'm going to recommend again, get in touch. Harold will send you a free copy of the books in PDF via the internet. Get a hold of them. Read the books because they're fun. And you're going to find the language that he uses and the style that he writes in to be wonderfully refreshing from this politically correct prison that we have woke up and found ourselves in. This is really something. But, you know, the books, Harold, give out your website again, please.
Okay, www.northwestfront, that's all one word, northwestfront.org, or www.northwestfront.net.
Okay, well, folks, like I said, you can get a free copy of the books. There's five of them, and this will keep you busy for the next couple of weeks reading them. But you're going to find yourself in a situation where you're reading and you're not going to want to put it down because it's that kind of exciting. I mean, there's tension, there's drama, there's romance, there's bloodshed and violence and all sorts of action going on. And, you know, above and beyond all that, it's a how-to manual. It really is. It's a how-to manual. And, you know, Harold, I know you studied the tactics and techniques of IRA. I know you served in the Rhodesian military. You learned a lot of these things by study and being in the field itself. And you put all these into a real easy, concise way that, you know, it's one of those kind of things, like if you take a kid, if you want them to study the Civil War, you take them to watch Gone with the Wind. You know, it's one of those kind of things. In this case, it's not a movie, it's a book. But you learn a lot about what happened during that time frame and that era. But this is what Harold's books are about. There's a bit of a how-to aspect in there. It doesn't have exact plans, but if you understand and you read between the lines a little bit, it's got some pretty exact plans. I just have to say it. So folks, don't miss this opportunity. I mean, get the books, read them, and you guys get back with me as to what you think of them, but I don't think you'll be disappointed with the time you invest in reading them.
Okay.
Anyway, I just had to give you a little plug there, a little promotion. You know, Harold, if you can't
every
tell,
little bit helps.
I'm a fan, okay? You know, and you only need 1,000 Class A Northwest volunteers, only 1,000. And, you know, there's people listening to this broadcast all over the country, all over the world. We got to get the word out there. We've got to increase this. I think that, you know, you're not my plan A. My plan A would be to retake this country and to, you know, make everything go, but you are my plan B, and you'll notice where I'm living now.
A lot of the people who want to come here, we were talking about amnesty and whatnot a while ago, a lot of the people who want to come here and get involved with the Northwest Imperative and the Northwest American Republic are European listeners. I've noticed this down through the years. Europeans get this. They get what I'm saying right off the bat. It's these dumbass Americans that can't seem to wrap their minds around the concept of separate independent nations on this continent. But Europeans get it, and a lot of them are actually, they're trying to come down. They're trying to get through the American immigration bureaucracy, but basically they're not 10-year-old Salvadorian child that was stuck on a train by his so-called parents.
Let's talk about that. I would recommend that any Europeans, South Africans, Russians, anybody who wants to come here, immigrate illegally. Come on a tourist visa, overstay, just move in, and then claim refugee status like everybody else does in this country. I mean, if the system is going to be abused to let the third worlders in, we need to have first world people here, too. Well, do the same stuff. If it works for them, it ought to work for you. There's supposed to be equal protection under the law, allegedly.
Did you hear of the heretical 2 case some years ago?
No, these two
Englishmen were basically trying to flee the United States in order to claim asylum because they had a warrant out on them in Britain for Holocaust denial. I wish these guys had contacted me first, and I would have told them the very first thing, which was don't do what they did. What they did was they got to the airport in Los Angeles, California, and they walked up to the first person in uniform that they saw, and they asked for political asylum. They were immediately bunged into an immigration jail where they spent the next year before being sent back to Great Britain. I wish those guys had contacted me first, and if there's any Europeans who are listening, please take me. I would love to see someone successfully claim asylum in this country against a Holocaust denial rap because, you know, basically it's not illegal in this country, so do not do that. Get into the country first on your tourist visa, whatever you have to do to get past that airport. Don't let them know you're coming. Just get past the airport, get out onto the street. Now, once you are out on the street in the United States of America, you still have a hard road to hoe because you're white, because you want legal status and so forth and so on, but then you can start working the system. You can't do it if they snatch you up at the airport and you're never legally admitted to the United States at all. So if any of you European or Australian or South African comrades out there might be listening to this and you're planning on either making a run for it, trying to get into the United States or come here for the Northwest Migration or whatever, your first job is to get past the airport. And I wish those two heretical two guys had talked to me first about that because I would have saved them a world of grief and they might basically have successfully claimed asylum.
Yeah, that's something we need to work on. And you look at Obama just granted a refugee status to 100,000 Haitians. What are 100,000 Haitians going to do to benefit anybody in this country? There's no value to bringing them here. They're not going to do anything to help the other 300.
What they did for Haiti.
Oh, yeah, that rate. My issue, that goes back to if the blacks are able to carve out a niche for themselves, carve out your
state
in the South.
I, I, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I made a brief, less than a day stop in Haiti in 1971. But that was when baby Doc was still in. But let me tell you something, Mike. If I was informed by a vengeful God that for my sins I had to be plunked down in some area of the world that is entirely controlled by blacks and be surrounded by nothing but blacks, I would pick anywhere in Africa, Somalia, before I would pick Haiti. It's
why do you think Haiti is such a mess? I mean, it's been
ruled by blacks.
Well, I know, but so is Central African Republic or Cameroon or Sierra Leone or Liberia. Yeah, well, they are, but you know, any place in Africa is better than Haiti. Why is that? I mean, Haitians?
It's kind of hard to describe. Haitians are just sorry. It's really difficult because I have a certain amount of time for certain Africans like Zulus, but Haitians, they have basically they've had that little one third of the island of Hispaniola for almost 200 years now. I think basically it's the effect of 200 years of black rule, but they haven't had any white people at all really to stiffen their spine or build up their infrastructure or give them any education at all. That basically they've been ruling themselves for 200 years now, jammed into that one little nasty island. And I'll say this for the Dominicans, like they always say, they're brown and they're proud of it. They don't tolerate Haitians coming into their part of the island. And so they've been, in essence, stuck there for 200 years with no company but their own, and I really can't describe it, but there's something about a Haitian black that is
not kosher.
I mean there are certain Africans I found that do seem to have somewhat, so I'll say this, I would prefer almost any African black to an American black. This is going to sound really strange because Africans are mostly much more racially pure than American blacks, but I swear to God, I think your average African is probably a bit smarter than an American black. But as far as a Haitian, or maybe that's just me, maybe it's just my personal taste.
Well, you know, I look at the situation in this country, and you're right. We're not allowed, no one is allowed to address the race issue. You can't talk about this in polite company. Nobody wants to hear it. The blacks get all hinky about it and get hostile. White liberals will call you names and other stuff. Okay, they call me names. Big deal. So what? I've grown a thick enough skin that I don't care what people say. It doesn't matter to me a bit. But I think it's time for black America and white America to get a divorce. I look at the situation in Ferguson, and maybe there's agitators and they're stirring the pot. I don't know. But blacks aren't happy with the current situation. Whites don't want to pay for it anymore. We spent $24 trillion, $24 trillion since the war on poverty began to try to make life better for these people. Do you know what? It's been an unmitigated failure. So
you really kind of wonder, where did all that money go? I would really be curious to get some kind of a breakdown and say all of our money that we spent on the so-called war on poverty since, 65 when LBJ brought in?
Yeah.
And just really get some kind of truthful breakdown as to where the hell all that money went. And a lot of it, of course, would go for just straight-out welfare payments to blacks, which in the 60s and 70s was bribes to keep them from rioting, and later on basically to buy their votes for the Democrat Party. But I would imagine a lot of it ended up in pockets which would really surprise you. Corporate cronyism, certain favored Democratic political figures, corporations of various types. A lot of it, I imagine, ended up overseas in various strange ways. Israel, I think we'd be amazed if we actually were able to get a breakdown as to where all that money went.
Oh, I'd like to see that as well, because somebody is making a couple points here and a couple points there on every transaction. J.P. Morgan Chase gets 2% off every EBT card transaction.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. But no, it's time for white America and black America to get a divorce. They're not happy. We're not happy. We're tired of paying for it. And so let's cut them loose. Let's give them the three or four states they want. That guy down in Georgia saying we need to have an African community down here in the South. You know, that I have no objection to him. Go ahead. You're on your own, bub. Good luck. Give us a call. You know, stay in touch.
And do for Georgia what they've done for Detroit and Newark.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you look at this, and one thing that I'm frustrated about and have been for a long time is that we spent this money and we've got this liberal paradigm that blames it all on racism and blames it all on institutional racism and things that are invisible that nobody can count or measure. And really, it's about the people. It's about who they are. What potential do they have? I still remember reading the book, The Bell Curve, and saying that the average black in this country's got an IQ of 85, the average white 103. IQ dictates financial success. And that's why blacks are lagging. Nobody wants to talk about that. I'm tired of trying to convince people to listen to these things. And maybe it's time just to let them go. So, all right, you guys are right. You're abused. You're oppressed. You need to have your own country. You can have the Deep South. It's yours. Good luck. I'd be willing to say goodbye to them. It's not going to hurt my feelings.
Well, again, that sounds all very nice in theory as we talk about it on the telephone here or debate about it on the internet. In actual practice, something like that probably will happen in the next generation or so, but it's going to be a lot more messy. There's going to be a lot of screaming and a lot of gunfire and a lot of blood as it does happen. A lot of our people keep, I don't know if it's wishful thinking or what, but they keep talking as if it is still possible for us to sit down with the blacks and the Jews and the liberals and the Democrats and the swine who run this country and say, come, let us reason together. We are not going to get anything off these people that we don't take. They regard us as, well, I don't know about subhuman, but they regard us as not their equals. As far as they are concerned, we are peasants or serfs or whatever. Our business is to shut up and to do what we're told and to keep this thing running for the, and so that their little playground can still function. There is no common ground between us and the blacks or the illegal aliens or the Democrats or any of these people. As far as they're concerned, we are sheep to be sheared, teats to be milked. Things have gone beyond the point, Mike, and they went beyond the point many years ago where reasoned discussion or logic or calm, dispassionate interaction of any kind is possible. It's I agree with James Howard Kunstler. The future of this country, either 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, whenever it happens, is large convoys of pickup trucks full of armed men rolling around the countryside cutting off heads in the manner of ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
You've mentioned this a couple of times now. Now, who do you envision these armed men being? Are these going to be Hispanics? I can't say Hispanics. They're the mosquitoes, the ones that are coming up.
This is why I say, and this is why I concluded my weekly podcast of Radio Free Northwest this week with one of the most important little homilies I've ever given. I believe that something of this kind is coming, and it is essential that we control the development of it. Some of the convoys of armed men and pickup trucks are going to be Hispanic. Some of them will probably be blacks until the pickup trucks break down and they can't fix them. But we have to control the breakup of the United States of America. The breakup of the U.S. has to be, insofar as possible, a controlled descent, kind of like crash landing a 747. There has to be at least some attempt to glide down or land on the treetops to kind of cushion the blow or something. But that's why we have to be ready. That's why I need those 1,000 people up here. We have to start preparing a political and physical defense against the breakup of the United States and make sure that when it does happen, the white man gets a piece of the pie, specifically the Pacific Northwest.
No, I'm still nostalgic, and I'm still clinging to the vision that we don't have to break the country up. We merely need to have some tough love type reforms to where we can get things back the way they need to be. But I will say that I'm currently in the Northwest, and this is by design. This is intentional on my part, because if it hits the fan, I'd rather be here than in Phoenix, Arizona, because that's already Aslan. I mean, I'm sorry.
That's another thing I tell people. Look, even if you don't want to get involved with the NF, even if you think I'm full of it or whatever, look, this is the best part of the country remaining to live in. For your own sake, come here. It is in your self-interest to come here. I tell people, as I mentioned, I think, before on your show, if you want to know what you've got to look forward to where you are on a fairly warm spring or summer night, open your window. If you can hear their voices, if you can hear booga, booga, booga and rap music on a boombox, if you can hear the salsa music coming out of the lowriders going by, if you can hear the gabble of Spanish, then you are too close. And eventually, okay, they're outside your house at night now. Eventually, they're going to be inside your house. Think about what your current neighborhood is going to be like 10, 15, 20 years from now. Do you really want to be 75 years old and living in the house that you're living in right now when the neighborhood has gone black and you're the only white person in three blocks? How long do you think before some of your dusty neighbors are going to come calling and break in the door?
The issue is, Harold, is that I've watched white flight since forced integration. Came about. People could no longer decide who they sold their house to or who they rented their apartment to. They were forced for integration. And I've watched white people flee. I've watched good neighborhoods. Ferguson, Missouri, for instance.
Yeah.
I have cousins who grew up there. Ferguson used to be a nice white area. And hey, guess what? It's not white no more. And, I grew up, not far from there. And it is a tragedy. This is a white flight is a failed strategy, but I don't have a better one right now. There's no way to keep them out. And that one thing that John damaged this country with was that Civil Rights Act and, how people who own property no longer have control over who they can rent to, who they can sell to. And so really, you don't own the property. Really, you're just, what do you call it, the trustee for the property. You're yeah. the caretaker. There you go, caretaker.
Feudalism.
And, yeah. And so it really kind of infuriates me that if we're going to have property rights, let's have property rights. But we don't. And so, like I said, I would like to go back and hit the reset button, because these programs of Johnson's administration in particular have been unmitigated failures. They have not worked.
Well, Mike, if you ever figure out any practical way that will work that we can hit that reset button, I'll be right there ahead of you. Unfortunately, it's not possible. We are going to have to look forward to a future that is bleak, that is grim, that will be extremely impoverished by the standards that we've come to be used to, and that will be dangerous and violent and bloody, because that is what happens when empires disintegrate and when societies collapse through a lack of moral fiber. And frankly, it's all our own fault. We could have maintained what we had here in the 50s and the 60s. We could have stood strong, and there's no darn reason for this to have happened except weak and lazy.
Well, I have to argue with that, because there was a lot of people out there who opposed the Civil Rights Acts, you know, and the segregationists in the South. They said, if you do that, these bad things are going to happen to you. And nobody believed them. Everybody believed the left wing, the liberal, the Frankfurt School argument that, oh, no, we're all equal. We need to integrate. We're being terrible to these people. It's not about being terrible to others. It's about taking care of your own. And
verbal opposition is not really opposition. I have always maintained that the turning point came in 1958 when Dwight D. Eisenhower ordered the United States Army into Little Rock, Arkansas to integrate the local high school at the point of a bayonet. But a complete total disregard for not only the people of that community, but the right of the states to determine their own affairs, et cetera, was utterly, totally wrong in so many ways. And that was the point where the South should have literally risen again, and I do not mean figuratively. That is the point where, in my view, the Confederate States of America should have been re-established and redeclared, and the Southern white men should have taken the damn rifles out of the closet and out of their gun racks, and the Confederate Army should have been reformed, and that basically we should have had Civil War II right then. Because that was the point of no return. When Eisenhower got away with using that type of force against the South in order to force blacks into our midst, and he was allowed to get away with it, that, I think, history will record, will be the point where we lost the entire North American continent.
Well,
because he saw that he could get away with it, just like Barack Hussein Obama is going to amnesty these illegal aliens because he knows he can get away with it. He knows that any opposition he meets will be in the form of words. Tyrants are not afraid of words. I probably shouldn't say what they are afraid of, because I'm sure the FBI is monitoring this like they monitor my podcast.
Strikes me I haven't had anything on here for the military buffs recently. This is the Hohenfriedberger March, or the Hills of Peace March by Frederick the Great. We'll be right back. Okay, it's time for Gretchen's contribution of the week. One comment on here, the technical quality on this recording seems to be a bit off. I did what I could with it with my wave pad, but Gretchen, the last few that you sent were really good quality-wise. I don't know what happened to this one, but see if you can go back to doing whatever it was you were doing before, okay? Anyway, here she is.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about The Convergence of Catastrophes by Guillaume Fay. Now, Fay talks about how, generally speaking, people tend to believe in miracles, and that we are intelligent but not wise, and that we've lost our survival instinct. Now, he talks about the destabilization of Europe, mostly due to depopulation, and, of course, the aging of the extant population, and how the French libertine idea has grown to the point that French culture and continuity may be wiped out. French people have often believed themselves better because to be French is about an idea, whereas Germany tended to see itself as more about descent. And Fay talks about how 50% of France is going to be African by 2050, and how the global South cannot develop as the West has, or if it does, it will create an ecological catastrophe. Now, some say that technology can help with this, but Fay says that he's not a believer in this. And also, how many in the West, or specifically how many Americans, would give up their cars, for example? He talks about how universalism is an illusion, and progress does not have to rest on a progressivist or egalitarian footstool. The global South does not have the fever for progress, and indeed it has no need for such a fever. Why, Fay asks, is progress so important? Today's economy is a casino economy. It tends to be based on spec. Now, Fay talks about how this catastrophe will bring about a drastic population reduction and the end of worldwide techno-consumer culture. But a new world can be concretely philanthropic, and that the South will remember its failure and will want to return to a simple life. And he ridicules this notion of the Enlightenment ethic curing the Enlightenment disease and how that cannot happen. Instead, he speaks of global zones and how some zones can maintain a certain degree of technological society, but others will go back to a simpler time. And this will happen with non-Western societies, and it will also happen in Western rural areas. And some whites may end up wanting to live on farms, and they'll want to support themselves with arts and crafts. And Fay really hoped for a very hard collapse, but that's only one of three possible collapse types. The first type would be a very soft collapse, where the European economy would be in ruin, and the new right would grow, but nothing would really happen, or nothing very bad would happen, and in 2020, the worst would be avoided. Now, the second kind would be a hard collapse, in which we have severe attacks by Muslims, and the UE disappears. And yes, the Muslims do take over some areas, but people change their minds about the worldview that they have, and they stop dreaming of a democratic life for all. Now, the third type of collapse would be a very hard collapse, and this would take place between 2015 and 2030, in which the UE would dissolve, the European economy would be in total shambles, there would be severe Muslim attacks, and it would get so bad that people would flee to safer areas. Now, he really hopes that the third collapse type will happen because really that will be for the best. And he's really inspired by something called the Shiva Linga Purana. This is a Hindu tale that talks about the end of a plurimillennial cycle. And he really hopes that this contains a great deal of truth. He talks about how this collapse really will be very good news because those who survive it will be much happier. He also says this tale tells us how people will somehow not survive this cataclysm. He ends this very long rant about the collapse of society with asking a very intriguing question. He says, who is God? And he just kind of drops us with that question. And evidently, he's hoping that this scripture will provide an answer to what will happen, this comeuppance, this rebellion of the earth against total exploitation. As an individual who is European and who is French, he also spends a great deal of time lamenting the lack of a work ethic in France. So you'll see a great deal of that. There's also a great deal of lamentation over a certain brain drain that he sees going on in France, a certain tendency for serious researchers to leave France and to go to the Anglo-Saxon world. Now, as compelling as this all is, one would have to say that if this terrible collapse is upon us, perhaps within the next few months, that these other concerns are somewhat secondary, I should imagine. But if you skip over these areas or you skim these areas, you'll get a very clear picture of a collapse being caused by both ecological catastrophe and also, of course, the economic and social collapse happening in Europe because of depopulation. Now, again, this is a European book, and therefore it has very high content. There's a lot of mention of philosophy, so it's a very rich book in that sense, and I always find European literature to be a joy to read because of its sophistication. So if you enjoy European literature, this is a book that you may want to read. So I hope you enjoyed my review, and have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
This is Trampled by Turtles.
Yeah. It's a broken heartbeat. I know the sound. Feels like your hands are nailed to the ground. It'll pass just like everything else.
Okay, I want to wind up on a serious note, more serious than it may sound at first. Now, you all know that I solicit people to send me MP3 audio files for the show, and I still do. Several weeks ago, a lady sent me one such file, ostensibly about Odinism. Now, normally I don't get into religion on here, at least not too much, but I think it's fatuous to pretend that there are not some diverse religious tendencies, pardon the expression, in white nationalism. And if I could allow Lord Lucan to talk about aliens in just one segment, I figured I could allow this lady to rap on a Satru for one installment and take whatever the Christian elements hollered and screamed at me. Now, the Christians complained that Hill of the Ravens was anti-Christian because I mentioned Wicca, and the anti-Christians screamed like banshees over my portrayal of Rooney and the Wingfield family in A Distant Thunder, so I'm used to it. But I noticed something as I listened to this lady's audio submission. It wasn't really about Odinism. What she was doing was trying to use my show to respond to and attack some internet trolls who had been giving her a hard time lately. Now, I won't name this lady or where she lives, but many of you would probably recognize her name if I did. And you would know that she is being driven around the twist by some, so far as I know, anonymous trolls who have seen that they can provoke her. Oh boy, can they provoke her. I think there's two or three of them who have just decided to slime the hell out of this woman for some reason, anonymous, of course, and I don't know if she's figured out who they really are yet. I wish to hell that there was some way to determine exactly who posts what to the internet, but there isn't, especially if the bad actor doesn't want to be found. And there's always a possibility it's some of Cass Sunstein's Jewish cognitive dissonance nerds operating out of the White House or some hidden lair of the Democratic Party trying to see if they can drive a white woman bonkers, which they always try to do. There was a reason that back in the day we never had female duty officers or had women answering the phone at headquarters. Word would get out among the local Jews that there was a female Nazi that they could scream their filth and obscene fantasies at, and all of a sudden we'd have a dozen of them calling, demanding to speak to the female, only that wasn't the term they used. Now, I deeply sympathize with this woman who sent me the MP3 file. Yeah, these assholes can be intensely stressful, especially if you're female and you're being completely falsely and unjustly victimized. You just want to lash out and keep on lashing out to somehow crush them like the cockroaches they are, but of course they're hiding from you behind proxy servers and computer monitors. Been there, done that, multiple times, and I can't absolutely swear to you guys that I won't have a relapse and that I will never be there and do that again, although, like an alcoholic, I really am trying to keep that particular bottle away from my lips. Back in the late 1990s, I was a Usenet addict, and I did and said and posted some things that I'm really not proud of because they lowered me to a level that I never want to find myself at. Look, ma'am, one of the hardest lessons I have ever had to learn, especially since it came at an age when you'd think I was old enough to understand this already, is that the only way to stop the goo-boo and the space madness is to just stop. Don't do goo-boo. Just don't. Don't wait for the other morons to stop first. They won't. I'm talking about you. You make the decision. I don't do goo-boo. Homie, don't play that. There is absolutely no conceivable worthwhile purpose in getting into a screaming contest on the internet with someone who is using a false name and concealing his whereabouts and his true agenda from readers and listeners. And I say that to you as someone who has done it in the past and who couldn't resist the rage and the temptation I'm asking you to resist. I'm speaking as someone who is able to tell you that the temporary feel-good factor you get from ripping into some internut is fleeting. It's empty calories because he will just come right back and bait you and lie about you some more. There is never any end to it, short of finding the troll's location, kicking in his door, and dragging him away from the computer and smashing his face and bones with baseball bats. And since you never know who and where these rodents are for sure, that's not really feasible, even if you are one of the rare individuals with the necessary testicular follication. The only way to deal with these people is to cut them off at the knees and do not acknowledge their existence. As some of you know, I have some experience in this field. There's a certain website that I have looked at once since it was put up, just enough to ascertain that it was of the nature that I'd been told it was, and never again since then. Nor do I allow any of my contacts to mention it to me, send me links, or engage me with it in any way. You have to do it that way. When you are presented with a bottle of poison, the only way not to be hurt is to not drink it. Forcing yourself to completely ignore this kind of crap from beginning to end is terribly, terribly hard. I know. But it's what you got to do. Ma'am, I understand why you're looking for allies in your battle against these crazy people who are lying about you and slandering you, but I'm sorry, I can't be one. Send me another audio file when you can do one that is solely on a racial topic, and good luck. I hope you can rise above these imbeciles. You really seem like a nice person, and you don't deserve what's being done to you. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.